ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What's on the mind of the country's biggest, most influential, and most innovative business leaders, founders, and creators?
You're in a very pessimistic place, Alan.
You get to find out every Friday with me, Alan Kohler, as I sit down with the people influencing the markets, the economy, and the ideas shaping our world.
I engage regularly, enthusiastically with the tech sector and some of these big players in AI.
Find That's Business with Alan Kohler on the ABC Business Daily feed, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcast.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people.
G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. Today, the second part of the Newcastle Writers Festival live show that we did last month. In case you missed the first part, this was all about me and my producers Pat Sunderland and Adair Shepherd sharing the stories we couldn't find time for in the show's regular schedule. I shared my story last week, and this time it's Pat and Adair's turn. They came up with some very strange stories that I think you'll love.
So I want to give you guys a bit of context to start this story. This is a story that came at the start of the year when the Black Swan series was airing. And sort of ironically, we were trying to predict what the most newsy story would be once we returned to regular programming. And as sort of quaint as the idea seems now, for a time we thought that was going to be the US and Greenland. We thought that was going to be the first thing we're going to have to address. And then Trump sort of went, oh, never mind, I don't want it.
Do you guys remember Greenland?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking, you know, we've got these extra production resources, maybe we could go to Greenland. Then I found out how long it takes to fly to Greenland, and I'm glad that, you know, we moved on from that.
Exactly. But for a little time there, I was researching Greenland and looking into the history of US-Greenland relationships, the times in the past that the US has tried to buy Greenland. And I came across this image. This is a hypothetical map of the United States. You might notice it includes Greenland. If you're a real map expert, you might also notice that it includes Canada.
Yes.
It also includes Mexico, all of Central America, and Cuba, and a big chunk of South America as well.
And all of the West Indies.
Oh, yeah, they're getting all of it. Anything that could conceivably be described as America adjacent.
I like that they've done a dotted line around the edge because they want half of the Pacific Ocean as well, clearly.
Yeah. Look, they're not greedy, just half.
Yeah.
So what this is the technate of America, and it was the proposal of a political and social movement in America. They're called technocracy. So I want to set the scene for you guys. Imagine it's the 1930s, right? We've just had World War I, the Great Depression is happening, everyone is unsatisfied with the way that society is being run.
Imagine.
I know, why would you? And so there's plenty of pitches for how we should do things differently. People are pitching communism, socialism, futurism, fascism, all of it. And then you're walking past a newsagent's and you see this political magazine.
Here, Pat is showing the cover of the 1933 Technocrats magazine depicting a very intimidating giant robot marching on Capitol Hill, holding thunderbolts in its hand.
How's this for an advertisement for your political party?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That is how to say... I mean, if Karl Marx had put King Kong on the front of Das Kapital, we'd all be speaking Russian or German right now. Like, this is how you advertise. This is the first edition of the Technocrats magazine.
Sorry, to be clear, they were advocating for this.
They kind of are saying, we can be the giant robot holding thunderbolts walking onto Capitol Hill. So technocrats, in a modern sense, means any form of government where you put someone with technological expertise in charge, like an economist in charge of a country going through a financial crisis. But what this party, Technocracy, believed is that all of society's problems were because we were not running it efficiently enough. And so society needs to be run more like a factory, more like an assembly line. And so you should put engineers in charge, electrical engineers, technical engineers. They shouldn't be elected. They should just be put in charge to build giant robots that will make us all live happier lives for some reason.
So how many people are on board with this idea so far?
Yeah. And can I say, they're pitching a universal basic income of $20,000 a year. At that time, that was $450,000. That was their pitch. They knew how to sell. Now, every movement needs a charismatic leader. And the leader of technocracy in New York in the 1930s was a guy called Howard C. Scott. This fella.
Yeah.
He looks pretty cool. Now, he became the leader of technocracy for a few main reasons. Firstly, he had all these accreditations. He had so many doctorates in engineering. He had all the stuff backing up his, you know, cred as an engineer. His second reason was that he knew how to make the idea more interesting politically. He could get other engineers on board, and he introduced like a doomsday element to this political theory. Basically, if you don't put engineers in charge, we're going to have millions of people out of work, we're going to have wars, we're going to have famine, you need to put engineers in charge. The third and most important reason why everyone liked him, which you can't get from this image, is that he was 6'5". In 1933, that's like being 13 foot tall today. This guy was the giant robot from the cover of the magazine, all right?
I see the resemblance.
Yeah.
Instead of lightning bolts, he's got a cigarette in his hand.
Yeah, and a cool hat.
Yeah, rad.
So under Howard Scott's leadership, technocracy really took off. Engineers started to gather. The New York Times wrote a bunch of periodicals about it, and membership was increasing. It was really starting to catch on. The only issue was that as it got more popular, more and more critics of the movement appeared. People who said, you don't seem to be very specific about any of the solutions you're offering, stuff like that. So Howard came up with a plan. He would hold a massive speech at the Hotel Pierre in New York. He would invite hundreds of people to this speech, naysayers, supporters, journalists, engineers, everyone, and he would broadcast it nationwide. And this speech was going to really sell the idea of technocracy. He was going to prove why it was important, why it was essential. He gave this speech, and this is the headline from the New York Times the next day. 400 leaders hear technocracy plea. Howard Scott leaves bankers skeptical on new solution. Bewildering, one says. He bombed. He tanked it.
How could they be skeptical of such a large man?
I know. He could easily crush them. I don't understand. I have some quotes here from the New York Times. Most hearers were disappointed with what they regarded as a confused presentation. Older women who were present said they did not feel any wiser, but were a great deal gloomier. My favorite was, there was a comedian in attendance, Will Rogers. He was a famous silent film star and a social satirist. And his quote in the Times was that technocracy was going to have the same shelf life as miniature golf, which he meant as a burn, but we've still got miniature golf, right? That was way more popular than he was giving it credit. We love miniature golf. This speech has been cited by a number of historians looking into this movement as the key moment that sort of killed technocracy. He did this speech that badly. The other factor was that journalists started to look into Howard Scott after this speech and discovered he never went to university. He didn't even graduate from high school. His engineering experience was a little bit of combat engineering in World War I, and he ran a floor wax company, which, you know, maybe you can call yourself an engineer, but you can't lead a political party whose whole point is let's be the smartest engineers and let's rule the world. So this was essentially the death of technocracy as a legitimate political movement. But Howard Scott had one trick left up his sleeve. After World War II, everyone was sad about the way things were being run again because we had just had another awful war. Howard Scott by this time had moved all of his most loyal followers from New York, where everyone was making fun of him, to Los Angeles, where everyone was like, cool, and who cares? And he decided to launch one massive last burst of publicity. He called it Operation Columbia.
It is suggested that we travel U.S. Highway 99 from Los Angeles to Vancouver. On the way back, we could travel Coast Highway 101, making lecture stops at all major cities en route.
So the idea was they were going to lead a massive speaking tour. They were going to get all the technocrats into a massive motorcade of cars, and they were going to drive all the way up the coast and all the way back down, giving speeches, holding rallies, and drumming up interest in technocracy, which seems like a fairly good idea, right? That's how you spread word of mouth. The only issue is that post-World War II, Howard Scott had become quite invested in the aesthetic of the Nazis.
Oh, no.
Everyone in his organization wore these gray suits. They painted all their cars gunmetal gray. They put their weird pseudo-religious political logos on the side of the cars. And they would lead these massive motorcades without any announcement of what was going on all the way up the coast. I don't want to make the obvious comparison, but this is 2 years after the end of World War II. The Nazis are as recent to these people as Wicked Part One is to us. It's still very much part of the conversation. I want to show you the end of this propaganda film they put out, and just think to yourself, does this give you hope about the future, or does it give you bad vibes?
From dawn till dusk, they are working for technocracy. Let's roll in the technate on the wheels of an official gray car. Salute and happy landings.
I did not add this music, ladies and gentlemen. This is the music. That's the music they put to their own propaganda film. It's an incredibly bad vibe. So unsurprisingly, Operation Columbia was another tremendous failure. The media response was ranged from ridicule to who the hell are these new Nazis? And it was essentially the final death knell for the movement. New membership slowed to a trickle. Howard Scott died in 1970. There are still some technocrats around. They call themselves Technocracy Incorporated, but they barely do not exist anymore. I went onto their official website. It is abandoned. And that's what I thought was the end of the story. But there is one important legacy that technocrats still have today. While all this was happening in the US, there was a sister movement in Canada. Technocracy had a really big moment at the same time. And that was led by a chiropractor called Joshua Haldeman. Does this man look familiar to anyone in the crowd?
No.
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 What if I were to compare him to this man?
Here, Pat shows a picture of Elon Musk.
Oh, God.
Joshua Haldeman, the chiropractor, a man who fervently believed in the idea that engineers should rule the world, is the maternal grandfather of Elon Musk. Luckily, Elon Musk shows no sign of following in his grandfather's belief that engineers should rule the world, but he does believe that they should rule a world.
Yeah, anyway, this is like an incredible thing to have, like this amazing city on Mars. And it's also an opportunity for the Martians to rethink how they want civilization to be. So you can maybe rethink, like, what kind of form of government do you want?
And that's my presentation on technocracy. Thank you very much.
Oh, my God. That was incredible. I've got to say, what? I don't feel wiser, but I do feel gloomier after that presentation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mine's a bit different. I kind of came across this story a few weeks ago because I've been very into the Asia Cup. I went to the final. Can I get a cheer for the Tillies? Yeah. Today, I'm going to be talking about a man who's a real champion of women's football. This is someone who's been promoting the women's game since the 90s. And that is...
Here, Adair shows a picture of former Supreme Leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, you might have been surprised to see the People's Republic of Korea at the Asia Cup, but they have a long history with women's soccer. And Kim has been championing it since before there was the first Women's World Cup, because the first men's FIFA World Cup was in 1930. But the first women's one wasn't until 1991. And about 5 years before that, when they'd kind of decided that the women's game was going to grow, before he had become the leader, before he'd succeeded his father, in the mid-80s, he took over the management of the athletics and sport department in North Korea. And he really saw real potential in women's football. And he announced that they'd establish 18 teams. He put programs into schools and into villages. He really invested in soccer. And it wasn't long before it paid off. They were, like, insanely dominant. Like, they were so incredible at women's soccer. They, from 2001 to 2008, they won 3 Asia Cup titles. And they reached the quarterfinals in the FIFA World Cup. And they were ranked 5th in the world throughout this time.
Damn.
And also, it was incredibly popular. Like, the attendance was crazy. The Tillies played a match in North Korea, one of the first home games that North Korea ever played, in 1998. And 58,000 people were watching. They may have been forced to be there, but I think it still counts, you know? And this is like consistently tens of thousands of people watching these games. It was massive. They'd be recognized on the street. Like, this is a time that women's football here was not a big deal, but it was, these guys were celebrities. Mm. Yeah, Kim Jong-il was not only a champion of women's sports, he was also a champion of the arts. In North Korea, they make one drama every year. And in 2011, the drama that they made was called Our Women's Football Team. I couldn't understand any of it. Also, what's the point of a TV show about women's soccer without a single lesbian in it? So there's no point. There were some weird plot lines as well, like players being too individualistic and being scolded for it. It was a very interesting vibe. Here's a clip, since the title's still going.
So the scene Adair plays here shows a couple of North Korean women's soccer players walking past some kids playing basketball. One of the soccer players picks up the basketball and kicks it with her foot straight through the hoop. Everyone cheers.
So no lesbians, but come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
She's so demure after having done it. I would be like, yeah!
But actually, around this time, things started to change for the North Korean women's football team.
Oh, okay.
So firstly, in 2010, you might know this, but after consecutive wins at the Asia Cup, the Tillies beat them in the Asia Cup final in 2010. And I think that was the start of the end. I think Sam Kerr undid it all.
Yeah.
Because a year later, at the 2011 FIFA World Cup, North Korea didn't play very well in their first round against the US. And at the press conference afterwards, I want you to guess what the coach blamed the loss for.
Capitalism. Mm.
Yeah.
Lesbianism.
Yeah. Close. He said that they were struck by lightning.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
That always throws you off your game.
Yeah. And this was kind of only the start. Basically, he said that a month earlier they'd been struck by lightning at a training game. Five players had been struck by lightning.
I feel like that should, like, if stories are the way that they are in comic books, that should make them more powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they weren't playing very well. But that was just the beginning, because a few weeks later, five of them tested positive for steroids. Yeah,
I thought you were going to say tested positive for 5,000 volts.
Yeah. Well, it's not far off, because the explanation they gave. So FIFA said that the substance they found had never been discovered before. And the North Koreans, they explained it by saying that it was a traditional medicine from the glands of a musk deer. So that's what, that's this animal.
Oh, yeah. You can tell that animal's good at soccer.
Yeah.
Does that animal have fangs?
Yeah.
Is that a vampire deer?
Yeah. I'm confused about where the gland is. Some of them said that the gland is near the fangs, and some of them said it's in the butt, but I'm not sure. So the reason that they had taken this substance was to treat the lightning strike. Yeah.
Nothing cures what ails you.
We thought it was anti-lightning medicine.
Yeah.
That's great.
So FIFA, for some reason, didn't believe this explanation. I don't know why. And it was a big scandal. It was one of the biggest doping scandals ever at a like major FIFA event. They were fined $400,000, and they were banned from the next World Cup. And this ban, like, it wasn't just a hiccup. After 2011, they hadn't played in a tournament for 15 years. This really wiped them out. And this Asia Cup was the first time they had played in 15 years. And it was meant to be their comeback. And of course, they were knocked out in the quarterfinals by the Matildas.
I feel like you've been telling this story for like 10 minutes and I'm already on North Korea's
side.
Yeah,
I know.
Right? Like when you said they got wiped out by the Matildas, I was like, damn it.
This isn't the end of the story, because while the North Korean women's team has been AWOL for 15 years, the youth teams have been absolutely dominating, because it runs in the family. Another champion of women's sport is Kim Jong-un, and he has established this soccer school called the Pyongyang International Soccer School. I don't think there's any international players in it, but it's international.
Yes.
And the biggest stadium in the world is also in North Korea.
Wow.
And he's just put a bunch of money into soccer, basically. And because there are sanctions on North Korea, these players can't play overseas. They only play with each other from 7 years old. And, like, the Tillies are off playing with all different teams. They're not playing together as much. These they play together incredibly. And the under-17s team are, like, so incredibly dominant, there are conspiracy theories about it. They have won 4 under-17s World Cups, which is twice as many as any other team. The last one, the 2025 one, they only conceded 3 goals in the entire tournament and scored 25, and that's the most goals ever scored in the history of the tournament.
Okay.
They are just so insanely dominant, and there's all these conspiracies that they're actually older than they are to try and explain it. So there's, like, a new golden generation. The North Korean women's soccer team is going to be insane in the next few years. Watch out for North Korea, basically. Yeah. We saw...
This is the most cheerful context that watch out for North Korea has ever been said. This is the most feel-good watch out for North Korea story.
These 16-year-olds in a few years might be... It might be a whole team of Samkos.
Pending lightning strikes, of course.
Mm. Of course.
And the population of the musk deer of North Korea.
Very good. Adia, thank you very much. Okay.
Thanks to Pat and Adair for coming along. It was a fantastic show. If you want to hear my story, it's in our podcast feed from last week. You can also hear more stories in my interview with Richard Feidler on Conversations last Wednesday. We'll put a link in the show notes today. There was an issue with how it was published initially in the Convos feed, but it's all fixed now. On Thursday, we're going to be taking a look at Palantir, the forebodingly named tech company that is getting involved in everything from government surveillance to airstrike targeting to the supply chain for your local supermarket. I'll see you then.